people who plant flowers specifically to attract bees and butterflies. There are adorable children's toys shaped like ladybugs and fireflies, which are actually beetles. There are even people who buy little enclosures to keep spiders and crickets and ants as pets. But when a fly shows up, instead of marveling at its complex beauty or celebrating its role in the ecosystem, we reach for the fly swatter. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You can swat all you like, and you won't really make a difference in the population of the order Diptera. There are 160,000 known species of flies, including fruit flies, house flies, gnats, and every kind of mosquito. And by some estimates, there are 17 quadrillion individual flies alive on Earth at any given moment. And while it's true, some of them bite and spread diseases, and lots of them gross us out, my guest says we should not overlook the fact that life as we know it wouldn't be possible without them. Jonathan Balcom is a biologist, researcher, and educator. His book is called Superfly: The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Jonathan, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Great to be here.
When you define flies as successful, what does that mean exactly?
Well, you covered a couple of points there. The numbers, the sheer numbers of individual flies, most of which are probably larvae at any one time. But also, and the number of species you mentioned, 160,000 known. I'm glad you said known, because it's estimated by entomologists, people who study insects, that there's probably close to five times as many species of flies as the number, as that number, 160,000. It's just they haven't been found or described yet.
Wow. And they don't live long, but they reproduce at an almost inconceivable rate. Can you like walk us through how many flies can exist within a few generations?
Yeah, I remember reading in the introduction to an entomology book when I was an undergraduate biology student and just being completely bowled over by some math that somebody did. It was a hypothetical situation, thank goodness, taking two fruit flies on January 1st of an imaginary year. And in 1 year, fruit flies can produce 25 generations. And if you take all of the flies from just generation 25, not counting all the other ones before that, If each female lays 100 eggs, half of them on average are males and half on females are females. So you do the math for the 25th generation alone. If you packed those flies very densely into a ball, that ball would reach from here to the sun and a little bit beyond. So about 93 million miles, if I remember correctly.
Wow. And the reason that we are not just straight flies from here to the sun is because a lot of those larvae don't mature, right? They don't all survive.
Checks and balances. That's right. Yeah, nature has checks and balances. A lot of creatures eat flies or their eggs or their larvae. And so right off the bat, not all of the ones are going to survive the first generation, and that affects all the subsequent generations. I think it's safe to say that any fly you see that's an adult fly with wings flying around or trotting around on your fruit bowl, that fly was a lottery winner, because there's a lot of ways that flies get winnowed out of the population before that stage.
But they can live on every continent, including Antarctica. How do they not freeze to death?
You know, I'm not actually sure the answer to that. They may have natural antifreeze. Certainly some animals do. But it's important. It's very good that they can tolerate colder temperatures than most other insects, because that makes them the champion pollinators of plants at high altitudes and high latitudes. The bees, which are the number one ranking pollinators, flies are next in line. The bees just can't tolerate those cold temperatures. So thank goodness for flies.
I loved reading about the pollination thing. And I'm embarrassed to say I reached the age I am without really knowing about this. I was on vacation last week in a place with tons of flowers. And for the first time, I paid attention to all the flies on flowers, because usually you look for the bees and the butterflies to sort of admire them. And then you see a fly and you think, what is that doing there? Get back to your dirty old hot dog or whatever you want to be on. But they're huge pollinators.
I'm touched that you looked for flies.
I did.
And it's true. It's true that if you don't look closely, they're easily overlooked. I actually paid a visit to the insectarium in Montreal while I was researching this book. And in the lobby, they had a very nice display on champion pollinators, I think they called it. And there were about 45 insects identified. Most of them were bees and wasps, maybe some butterflies, because we all love looking at them. Not a single fly was among them, and yet flies are critical pollinators. They're as I said earlier, they're ranked second only to the bees and wasps. So we have a lot to thank them for in that department.
Specifically, no flies, no chocolate?
Well, apparently, as far as is known, there's only one known insect with the ability to pollinate the devilishly hard to get in at chocolate, or rather cocoa flower. And it's a very complex flower with narrow niches, I suppose. And there's a tiny, very unspectacular midge, which has been dubbed the chocolate midge because it's the only known insect able to pollinate cacao plant, which leads to the main ingredient for chocolate. So, yeah, thanks to them.
I did not realize there are species of flies, or at least one, that can live underwater, not just go in the water, but live in the water.
That's right. Mark Twain wrote with passion about meeting this fly, and this fly is able to sort of burrow into the surface of the water, and with a combination of oils and bristles on its body that helps to capture a bubble of air. So the fly then can swim his or her way down to the bottom of this particular lake and can run around on the bottom feeding on algae and whatever else they feed on. The tips of their legs and their mouth parts are conveniently able to emerge from the bubble, so they can carry out this foraging behavior underwater, and then they pop up to the surface again, as Twain put it, as dry as a patent report.
So while we're at it, what makes an insect a fly and not a beetle or a wasp or an ant?
I'm glad you asked that, because it is a little confusing. I mean, they're true insects, so they have six legs. But unlike the other flying insects, they only have two wings. The hind wings got modified some long time ago in their evolutionary history into these two baton-like structures, a little stick and a knob at the end, which is no good for keeping the animal aloft, but it acts as a flight stabilizer and sort of a gyroscopic kind of thing for balance. So it seems important, but it doesn't keep them aloft. But it may be with the simplicity of having the two wings that maybe lends itself to their being such accomplished flyers. You know, when you consider a house fly can do a little flip and land on a ceiling and then trot along the ceiling. And some flies can beat their wings at over 1,000 times per second. That would be a small fly. And so they are remarkably adept at flying and maneuvering.
But there are flies with no wings at all, right?
Yes. Flies are kind of the entrepreneurs of the insect world, and they take advantage of different... They've adapted to an enormous array of niches. And I don't know if a fly ever regrets not having wings. The ones who don't have wings probably don't know that they have kin who have wings. But there are flies that have co-evolved with bats. There's several hundred bat flies in the world. I used to study bats. I remember seeing a couple of them skittering around under the fur of these bats, and they spend their whole life there. And their hosts, the bats, are the ones that do the flying for them. So they get couriered around, they get moved around by their flying hosts, the bats. And there's other flies, sheepkeds, for instance, which don't even look like a fly. They almost look more like a mite or a tick. And yet they're true flies, but they've shed their wings a long time ago in evolutionary history for the simple reason they don't need them for their life history.
All right, I want to talk about fly eyesight. Males in a lot of fly species have what's called holoptic vision. What does that mean?
Kind of like sense around. There's a picture of a big-headed fly in my book, and it's just an amazing fly to look at. It's small and an incredibly good flyer, but the males have, it looks like, it reminds me of the nose of a traditional clown, that big bulbous red nose stuck on the head of this fly, stuck over the head. The whole head looks like these two red eyes, which are surrounding the head, so it almost kind of looks like one single eye. This gives them the ability to obviously see in all kind of angles, in front, above, below, behind, which is very useful for avoiding danger, but also if you're a male, and the males have this characteristic, to spot and pursue a tempting female during reproductive time.
So why would females have dichoptic vision, which does not sort of go all the way around?
It's a great question. I don't have a patent answer to that. I would say it's once again back to checks and balances. Their need to find mates, males are going to come to them, so they don't need to perhaps have such good vision. But having smaller eyes, which is to say perhaps smaller heads as well, gives them a little bit more flight maneuverability. So there's probably benefits to them not evolving those big eyes that the males have.
Not a lot of wild creatures have benefited from the spread of human beings into almost every ecosystem on the planet. I guess mosquitoes, which are a type of fly, are an exception to this, right? Because, among other things, they like to eat human blood.
That's right. I think I have to say, you know, no offense to humanity, but most species of animals wouldn't be too upset if we were to go away, or at least if our numbers went down significantly. But I don't think for some of those mosquitoes would be among them. Those insects that take advantage of our blood supply. I estimated. I did some calculations while I was working on my book, and I estimated it's about 4,600 square miles of human skin surface in the world for mosquitoes. Mosquitoes or any other biting flies or biting insects, but most of the ones that go after blood are members of the fly group. So we are a pretty useful thing for some of them, but not for most. I was also stunned to learn that of all the vertebrate animals in the world today, about 60% by biomass are livestock, animals that humans are raising to eat. And then humans make up about another 36%. And then that leaves 4% for wildlife. So we've really, really, it's a good illustration for the fact that we're in what's called the Anthropocene, in an era where humans have sort of taken over the functioning of the planet.
But if we're bitten by a mosquito, we know 100% that mosquito was female.
I don't know of any species of mosquito, and there's 3,500 of them that we know of, in which males bite humans. There are other biting flies that both males and females will bite. But in the case of mosquitoes, as far as I'm aware, it's exclusively females that are after the blood. And they don't go for our blood to nourish themselves specifically. They go for the blood to nourish their eggs. So most mosquitoes need to take a blood meal and fill up and double or triple their weight in human blood before they can successfully lay eggs.
Wow. So is it true that some people are more attractive to mosquitoes than others? More delicious?
Apparently, yes. It's flimsy evidence. I don't know of any recent studies, which is a bit surprising because it seems like something that could concern everybody. What color clothing should I wear? Is there some food I can consume that might make me less attractive to a mosquito? The flimsy evidence supports a few things. Male humans seem to be a little more attractive than females. And if you've exercised and you're sweating, maybe because you're putting out more CO2, that's one of the several cues that mosquitoes cue in on. I think it's black, dark clothing may be more attractive. I have to admit, I keep forgetting that, whether it's dark or white. I need to look it up in my own book. But also alcohol. So if somebody drinks beer, I shouldn't say alcohol in this case. I think it's beer specifically that's been noted as there's some being evidence that mosquitoes are more attracted to people who have been drinking beer.
And is there some reason why we don't feel ourselves being bitten until it's too late?
I live in Southern Ontario, so I go hiking every week. So certainly this time of year, I'm encountering lots of mosquitoes, and it seems like there's a few seconds between that impact of when they land on your skin, if you feel it at all. Some of them manage to sneak up very effectively and land and start feeding without one noticing it. But there seems to be a bit of a lag, but it's not long. They get to work quickly because they have to. Like I said earlier, it's a very dangerous thing to do. I saw a remarkable film. I don't know quite how it was done, but they actually filmed from under the skin. It was probably a fake skin and translucent, and they put capillaries in there. I'm not quite sure how it was done, but you could see the tip of the proboscis of the mosquito probing around and literally flexing to find that capillary to strike the point. And you got to figure, sometimes they're going to strike a little nerve cell or a little axon, nerve tissue, which would make it more painful. You may have noticed, I certainly have, that sometimes when a mosquito bites me, I just see them there tanking up, and I had no sensation of pain at all. So sometimes they're sort of lucky that way, and they don't cause any pain. More often they cause pain. I will add one other note, and that is that we tend to develop an immunity to their saliva as the biting season progresses. So mosquito bites are more likely to be itchy and annoying earlier in the season than late in the season. And apparently it is the saliva itself that causes the irritation. The saliva has anticoagulants, which allows them to take in more blood quicker, and they don't clog up their tiny little straw, because red blood cells would clog it up if they didn't have that anticoagulant.
I'm pretty sure I never want to meet a robber fly, but now I'm really curious about them. These guys are big enough to take down a hummingbird?
I was as surprised to learn that as probably you were. But I have seen, I actually saw my last harbor fly 4 days ago here in Ontario. They occur here. There's, of course, hundreds, probably many thousands of species of robber flies, but I kind of think of them as the Rolls Royce of flies. They're pretty impressive looking. They're long, slender bodies. I'm sure many listeners have seen them, maybe not knowing what they were. But the largest of them can get to well over 2.5 inches long. And apparently there's some, on rare occasions, they have been known and observed to take down a hummingbird, which even the smallest hummingbird is still going to weigh a lot more than the fly. But such is the bravura of a robber fly that they'll go after a lot of things that they see. They perch on a branch or a leaf, and they have huge eyes, big, excellent vision, and they wait for something suitable to fly by. I've discovered them perching before, but I've yet never actually observed an attack. I did meet a biologist while I was researching this book who had he sort of putting together a pain scale of robber fly bites. There's another guy who's become famous, or infamous, if you like, for a pain scale for wasp stings and bee stings and ant stings. But this particular guy, if he catches a robber fly, he'll sort of harass the fly and push it against his skin so that he can hopefully induce the fly to bite. These flies are reluctant to bite because, well, we're not really a food source for them. They use their bite mainly to subdue and also inject a liquefier, hormones or compounds that liquefy the innards of their prey, making it suckable so they can suck it out. But anyway, this guy has done a pain scale, and generally the pain is not overwhelming in the way it can be from a bullet ant or some of these other bees or wasps.
Many flies are not parasites, but parasitoids. What is the difference?
A parasite lets the host live, which makes sense as a strategy, because your host is your food supply. So if you can get your food, get your nourishment without killing your host, that gives you much more time to live on the host. A parasitoid is a little more sinister. Parasitoids kill the host. But typically, after they've gotten what they needed to get out of it, of course. So a parasitoidal wasp, for instance, the young have developed into the point where the larvae, where they can hatch out and pupate before the host, it could be a caterpillar, for instance, before the host dies. And once the host dies, the little wasp larvae, grubs have had their way and gotten what they needed, so it doesn't matter. So that's the distinction between the two.
How do flies know that there is something good to eat that has not been on their sort of regular path of travel before then? Like, how did flies recently discover that there was a rotting potato in my cabinet?
Without knowing what kind of flies they were, do you know if they were fruit flies? It was probably fruit flies, I'm thinking.
I think they were, yeah. But they're not usually in the kitchen, but, you know, flies can find things. So I guess I want to know about their sense of smell.
Yeah, they have an excellent chemical sense. These taste buds that are all over their bodies and their ability to smell. But suffice to say that they are extremely clever at finding different kinds of foods. We haven't talked yet about rotting bodies, and that's certainly their ability for blowflies and flesh flies and some other specialists to detect the decomposition of a body, be it a human body in a murder case or be it some road-killed animal or any other animal. You see these flies buzzing around. They have a very acute ability to detect the decomposition process within minutes of death, and they start to arrive on the scene. And different species of flies are specialists on early decomposition, and some on mid-stage, and some on late-stage decomposition. So different species arrive at different times, and it turns out that information is very, very useful for determining time of death. which is a very important statistic in trying to solve, say, murder cases. And so these flies and their maggots, in particular the stage of development of their maggots and eggs, etc., are used as a yardstick for determining when and sometimes where a body may have originated when he or she died.
And this is actually something people have understood for a very long time, right?
Yes, certainly many, many centuries, 1,000 years or more, an early case in China where somebody was dead and the wife claimed that he died of natural causes, but they took her scythe and they put it out and it attracted flies, and the body of her husband had been burned, but there was still evidence on the skull of her having used the scythe to hit him in the head. That was a poorly described case by me, but I can suffice to say there's many, many cases where the presence of maggots and flies at various stages has led to both convictions of murder cases, but also exonerations, evidence that somebody actually didn't commit the crime when originally it was thought so, and it was the fly evidence that reversed the verdict.
Why do flies do this weird thing? When you're watching them close up, they'll sort of rub their front limbs together like a Batman villain who's just set some kind of trap. What are they doing when they make that gesture?
I always think they look like a gourmand who's getting ready for a meal.
Oh.
And in fact, maybe I'm a little closer than you in that score, because as we know, that flies that can taste through their feet. So by continually or often rubbing the feet together, it's one possible reason for that is that it's cleaning off any residue from previous meals and making the taste buds all fresh and ready to detect the presence of something new. So it's a little bit like the fly equivalent of us clearing our palate before the next bite.
Are there things we could do? I know it's sort of a holy grail in science to keep mosquitoes that cause diseases under control without eliminating the beneficial effects that they have on the ecosystem overall. Where's the progress on that?
Yeah, there's a number of strategies, of course. One of the most effective has been bed nets, particularly bed nets treated with an insect repellent or insecticide. Pyrethrin, I think, is the main one used. However, insects are very nimble evolutionarily because they have short generation spans. And there's evidence now that that some of the insects that have been repelled by bed nets are now shifting their active feeding periods to the day instead of the night. Other strategies that humans have used include what's called the sterile male technique, where not billions, but trillions of male flies have been bred and produced in facilities. The Moscomed program between Mexico and the United States is an example. And then the idea here is to release vast numbers of sterile males who will outcompete through being more numerous the wild, not sterile males. The sterile ones outcompete them and get most of the matings with females who then don't produce offspring. So that technique has borne some fruit, has been effective in some regions. It's generally accepted nowadays, though, that we may suppress these populations, but they are so nimble, as I say, evolutionarily, they adapt to our attempts to reduce them. And so suppressing them rather than eliminating them is probably more realistic. And for ecological reasons, that may in the long run be for the better.
Why are fruit flies so popular as research animals?
Partly because it's a cheeky answer. Partly because they are so popular as research animals. What I mean by that is that one of the paradoxes of science and knowledge is that the more questions you answer, the more knowledge you acquire, the more questions you have, the more knowledgeable you are, the more ignorant you realize you are, because there's always new questions. And fruit flies have been studied intensely. I mean, their entire genome has been mapped out. There's over 100,000 published scientific articles using fruit flies, 7 Nobel Prizes, including last year's Nobel Prize for the gene editing technique CRISPR, have been awarded awarded to research largely done with fruit flies. So I think part of the appeal here is that there's just a huge database to work from. There's a huge foundation on which to build new research, plus the fact that fruit flies are very, very user-friendly. They're quick to generate, so you can get lots of generations quite quickly. They're very easy to rear. They're not fussy about food. You know, you can feed them with the formula that's pre-made, but you can also just toss in a banana peel sort of thing, and they're happy, and they'll be mating and courting and doing their fruit fly stuff in there. So those are a couple of reasons why they're so popular to use.
And there are lots of interesting facts about fly reproduction here, but give us some of the highlights, some of the things that you thought were most interesting about how flies beget more flies.
Yeah, fly sex comes in 50 shades of brown. There's foreplay, where I mentioned courtship, where usually male flies are doing, you know, maybe buzzing their wings in a certain way to make songs, to make complex sounds, serenades, if you like, to hopefully attract a female. There's a lot of competition between males, and you'll get flies who literally rear up on their hind legs and they're boxing each other. Sometimes gift giving. The dance flies are famous for the males giving gifts to the females. I say famous, probably most people don't know about it, but famous among entomologists or people who take an interest in insects. Males will catch another insect, often a fly, a smaller fly, or even a bigger one, and then offer it to the female so that she's preoccupied during mating, which is a good strategy because they're a bit like the traditional idea of the praying mantis, where the female may eat the male. So by giving her a gift, you may improve your chances of getting away for maybe a second mating with another female. And then there's some who actually wrap their gifts in silk, presumably to buy more time to have their way. And then there's some who have evolved to actually just give them the wrapping with nothing inside. So maybe that's a little bit more of a high-risk strategy. One other thing I'd like to mention about fly sex is that With all the different kinds of flies, there's some species that are very, very similar, and it's thought that one of the ways that flies have evolved to distinguish between the right species and the wrong species to mate with is simply that they have very, very complex genitalia, and there are actually books written on fly genitalia because they are useful ways for scientists to discriminate one species from another. And it's thought that they may be a useful way for the flies themselves to discriminate one sex from another. And in many species, the genitalia must rotate 180 degrees after interlocking to complete the process, which is why you may on occasion, I've only seen it once myself, but you may on occasion find one fly perched on a tree trunk or on a sign or something outside, and the other fly attached, hanging below, upside down, with the legs facing outward.
Wow!
It's a kind of a little bit of a compromised position to be in when you're mating, but I guess it's worth it in the end.
Jonathan, should we be thinking about the ethical implications of using millions upon millions of these animals for lab research? I mean, we worry about how it might feel for a rat or a rabbit in a lab, or an octopus. Do flies suffer being used as test subjects?
There is evidence for hypersensitivity, long-term pain in flies that have been experimentally had a leg amputated. For instance, 3 weeks later, they show a hypersensitivity to, say, heat pain that an unamputated fly doesn't show. This is, for instance, putting them on a hot plate. It's a temperature that is sort of approaching the tolerance limit for a fly. The one who's had an injury a few weeks earlier runs off that hot plate at a lower temperature than unaffected flies. So that's an example of the type of approach now that scientists are actually, it's interesting that a scientist is actually asking questions about pain and attention spans and decision making and what we broadly call cognition. But we've known about the honeybee waggle dance for decades now, and how complex that is, symbolic language. So these are other insects, and insects are, as we look closer, they're so much more complex than we thought they were.
Your rule, your personal rule, is to only kill flies in self-defense. What does that mean to you, self-defense?
Well, if I'm out hiking and the mosquitoes are having at me, sometimes I'll give them a second chance, swat them off, you know, just brush them off. But if they're persistent, I know why they're there. I know they're after my blood. So I think it's fair enough to defend in that case. But proactive killing, I much prefer to let a bunch of fruit flies out into the yard after catching them in my handy little kitchen fly trap than I do to swat them or to smash them. I feel like I'm liberating a little bit of my soul when I let them go outside.
Jonathan Balcom is a biologist, researcher, and educator. His book is called Superfly, The Unexpected Lives of the World's Most Successful Insects. Jonathan, this has been really interesting. Thank you for making time to talk to us.
I really enjoyed it, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.